Professor Francis Yan.
Thanks, Sabina. It's a pleasure to be here. So I'm going to be talking about Enceladus, which is a small icy moon of Saturn. And before I go any further, I have a tendency to drop into jargon. And so if I inadvertently do so, please just stick up your hands and get me to explain it. I'll try and avoid it, but it does sometimes happen. So this is an artist's impression of what Enceladus might look like. There's Saturn in the background from 1981. And you can see that it has these rather fanciful fountains on the surface. And the remarkable thing is that it turns out that this artist's impression is actually not very far removed from reality. And the reason that we know that is because of Cassini. Cassini is a spacecraft that went into orbit around Saturn about 5 years ago. And that's the source of all the data that I'm going to be talking about today. So, because of this audience, I thought I'd spend a couple of minutes describing what I mean by planetary physics, and also a couple of minutes trying to justify my existence. Why should you care about icy moons? But then the bulk of the talk, I'm going to be focusing on Enceladus, and I'm going to try and answer three questions. Why is it active? Why does it have these rather dramatic geysers from the surface? Does it have an ocean somewhere beneath its ice shell? And how has that ocean evolved over time? So, planetary physics. If I had to describe what I do in one sentence, then it's basically to try and get an answer to this question. How did planetary bodies evolve to their current state? And this is a useful question because it really involves two things. You have to think about what they're like at the present day, what's their internal structure, stuff like that. But you also have to think about how they've changed over time. So there's a characterization, but there's also a history aspect. Now, planetary physics is an observational science, very like astronomy. You can't run experiments, but what you can do is to make predictions. And one of the most famous predictions was made in 1979. The prediction was that Io, a satellite of Jupiter, would be extremely volcanically active. And 2 weeks after the prediction was published, things like this were seen. This is a volcanic eruption jetting stuff several hundred kilometers above the surface of Io. So you can't run experiments, but you can make predictions. In some ways, we're unlucky compared with astronomers. Astronomers have, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of stars to look at. We're very restricted in the number of bodies that we can look at. So it's rather a data-starved industry. In some ways, it's a lot more complicated than astronomy. Basically, stars are relatively simple objects because they're made of a couple of things and they're very hot. Planets are made of lots and lots of different things and they're much colder. And so they're sort of intrinsically more difficult. And it's a young field. I would argue that although we're using 21st century technology to collect the observations, that the physics that we do would be understood by anybody from the 19th century. It's not that sophisticated. Okay, well, here's the playground. Here are the icy moons of the outer solar system. This is the Earth's moon for scale. Jupiter has four big moons. Saturn has one big moon and a bunch of medium-sized ones. There's Enceladus. We'll talk about that more later. Uranus has five medium-sized ones, and Neptune has one big one. So these are the objects that we're going to be interested in. Why should we care about them? Well, for a start, you just saw there are a lot, maybe a couple of dozen. And that's nice because we only have four terrestrial planets to play with. Given a couple of dozen objects, we can actually start to work out what processes are unique to a particular object and what processes are universal. So having a larger number helps you sort out what's important and what's sort of accidental. Even if you glance at them very briefly, you can see that they look very different on the surface. And so they've obviously had different histories. And furthermore, many of them record different epochs on their surface. Some have bits which are very young next to bits that are very old. And so they record a significant amount of solar system history. And so we can use them to sort of turn back the clock and work out how they've evolved. In some ways, they're intrinsically more complicated than the terrestrial planets. And in particular, the energy source that drives their evolution is the gravitational energy in the orbit. And that's completely different from somewhere like the Earth. The Earth doesn't care about how its orbit is changing. That has no effect on the Earth's interior. But for these satellites, the thing that controls whether or not they heat up is their orbit. And so there's a coupling between the orbital and the thermal evolution that simply doesn't apply to the terrestrial planets. Astrobiology is a fashionable science right now, and astrobiologists are very interested in bodies like this because many of them seem to have liquid water oceans beneath the surface, and liquid water oceans are a potentially habitable environment. And so icy moons make astrobiologists excited. And finally, if we can understand these objects, then maybe we can apply the lessons to elsewhere, places we know even less. For instance, there are Kuiper Belt objects in the fringes of our solar system, and there may be super Ganymedes in other solar systems. Okay, all the data that I'm going to talk about comes from Cassini. Cassini was built in the good old-fashioned days of NASA, where they threw a couple of billion dollars at a spacecraft and did a good job. It's powered by radioisotopes. One of the savings that they made is that it doesn't have a scan platform. That doesn't sound very important until you realize that it can either look at the surface of a satellite or it can send the information back to Earth, but it can't do both simultaneously, which makes very complicated operations. It's been around Saturn for about 5 years, and it's done many flybys of Enceladus, some as close as a scary 25 kilometers. That's pretty close in astronomical terms. And it seems to be in very good health. It may keep going for another eight or so years. Okay, so zooming in on Enceladus, here is the Saturn system again. MET Dr. Thip is a useful acronym. Mimas, Enceladus, Tethys, Deinerea, etc., etc. And there's Enceladus. It's the second one out. It's pretty close. It's only about 4 Saturn radii away. And so its orbital period, its year, is very short. It's just over a terrestrial day. Its orbit isn't quite circular. It's very slightly elliptical. The measure of the ellipticity of the orbit, the eccentricity, is 0.0045. The reason for that is that it's in a resonance with Dione. Dione goes around Saturn exactly twice as slowly as Enceladus. And so Enceladus and Dione perturb each other and cause their orbits to be slightly non-circular. And you'll see later that that's actually very important. The other thing to remember about Enceladus is that it's tiny. It's about the size of the United Kingdom. So it's very, very small compared to the Galilean satellites, for instance. And this is what it looks like. Its density is intermediate between that of rock and ice. The surface is ice. Presumably somewhere in the inside, there's a silicate core. Even on a global scale, you can see that it's a geologically interesting object. Some parts of it are very heavily cratered, so they're old. They just sat there getting bombarded. But there are other bits that have very few craters and are cross-cut by geological fractures or faults. And so some parts have not done very much. Other parts have been geologically active more recently. So it's clearly had a complicated history. But the reason that everybody is excited about Enceladus is because it's actually active right now. And so this was the discovery image. This is heavily stretched. But what you're seeing is a cloud of ice particles being blasted out from the South Pole. If you unstretch this image slightly, you can actually start to see the individual geysers. These are these filaments that are jetting out ice crystals and water vapor into space. So Enceladus is very unusual in that it's geologically active at the present day. The geysers are all coming from the South Polar region, which is this region down here, and this has been nicknamed the Tiger Stripe region for obvious reasons. There are these individual long fractures from which the geysers are emanating. You can see that this region is young because it doesn't have lots of impact craters on it. It must have been created relatively recently, and it's centered pretty much exactly at the South Pole. Here is a blow-up of that region, 30-kilometer scale bar. These are the individual tiger stripes. This is a false-color image. The variations in color you're seeing are basically grain size of the ice. So here are the tiger stripes, and there's the South Pole. We don't just have images. We also have temperature maps. And it turns out that the South Pole is much hotter than it should be. This is a prediction of what the temperature distribution on Enceladus should be, and this is what you actually get. And you can see that the South Pole is anomalously hot, and it's anomalously hot by a large amount, you know, so up to 10 Kelvin. And so this is just a map of that temperature anomaly centered on the South Pole. And if you integrate the excess temperature up, then you can work out how much heat is coming off. And in numerical terms, it's several gigawatts. That probably doesn't mean very much to anybody. If you convert it into a heat flux, what this means is that this region of Enceladus is putting out as much heat per square meter as a tectonically active region of the Earth. And so tiny little Enceladus, locally, is getting out as much heat as an actively deforming part of the Earth. So somewhere in there, there's a big heat source. You can actually look at higher resolution measurements, and the high res measurements show you that it's not smoothly distributed. The tiger stripes are actually significantly hotter than the surrounding material. So the heat source seems to be concentrated at the tiger stripes themselves. Something else you can do is to measure how much material is coming off. This is a plot of column density in the plume as a function of time. The crosses are the actual observations. The lines are models for different fluxes, and by sort of minimizing the misfit, you can work out that Enceladus is losing several hundred kilograms per second. Again, that doesn't mean very much. The way to think about this is that if those geysers had been operating for the age of the solar system, Enceladus would have shrunk in mass by a few tens of percent. Okay, so this is a significant mass loss over geological time. And you can also work out how fast the stuff is coming off, and it's coming off faster than the escape velocity. So most of this stuff that comes out never comes back, and in fact, it forms a ring, a faint ring, around Enceladus called the E-ring, which astronomers had known about, but they didn't know where it came from. So it comes from the geysers. So just to summarize, the tiger stripes are located at the South Pole. I don't think that's a coincidence. I actually think that the tiger stripes could have formed anywhere, and because of the likely mass anomaly associated with the tiger stripes, wherever they formed, they would have actually reoriented the satellite to one of the poles, and so you get a true polar wander event, a bit like may have happened for the Earth. I'm not going to talk about that here. What I want to talk about are the tiger stripes. So we know how much heat is coming off, we know how much vapor is coming off, and we know that the tiger stripes themselves are hotter than the surrounding material. And so ultimately, these are the observations that I'd like to try and explain. Okay, just to pause. Remember, this is the kind of overarching question that you want to get after as a planetary physicist. And so for Enceladus, as far as its current state is concerned, we can think of at least two questions. One is, you know, why is it active at all? That makes it almost unique. And we can also ask the question whether or not there's an ocean, because that keeps astrobiologists happy. And then if we've answered those two questions, we can then think about how it's evolved over time. And in particular, it will become clear that whether or not the ocean is a recent feature is actually, it's an interesting question. So these are the questions that I want to ultimately go after. Okay, well, first of all, how do we explain the activity? Well, Isaac Newton would have known the answer to this. And basically, it comes down to tides. So here's Saturn. This is Enceladus. Because Enceladus has a finite width, the point here experiences a bigger acceleration than the point there. And so you end up with a slightly deformed body. Now, remember that the orbit of Enceladus isn't quite circular. So that means that at some points in the orbit, it's close to Saturn. Other points in the orbit, it's far away. And so the bulge gets bigger and smaller and bigger and smaller as it goes around Saturn. So the bulge is doing this over the course of an orbit. And just as if you take a rubber ball in your hands and you squeeze and you stretch it and squeeze and stretch it, it's going to heat up. Similarly here, some of that mechanical work is going to get converted into heat. And so, because it's in an eccentric orbit, it's going to get tidally heated. That energy can't come from nowhere. Ultimately, it has to come from the gravitational energy of the orbit itself. And so what happens is that the orbit will slowly shrink, and as it does so, because of conservation momentum, the orbit will become more and more circular. So the orbit gets more circular, and the heating goes down. And so if Enceladus was just sitting there on its own, its orbit would have become perfectly circular, and it would be dead. The reason that it's not dead is that Enceladus and Dione are talking to each other, and that keeps the eccentricity from getting too small. And so the reason that it still has an eccentricity and it's still tidally heated is because of this resonance with Dione. So in a general sense, the reason Enceladus is active is because of tidal heating. But what this doesn't explain is, you know, why is it focused on the tiger stripes? So I think the answer is as follows, that the tiger stripes are faults. They're fractures in the surface of the ice shell. And if you calculate how the stresses, the tidal stresses in the shell, vary over the course of an orbit, then what they do is they move the sides of the fault backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. And just as on a cold day like today, if you rub your hands together, you get heating, so too the two sides of the fault, as they rub backwards and forwards, will generate heat. And so the tidal stresses can lead to backwards and forwards motion, to strike slip motion, and that will generate, that's a source of heat. Now, this isn't entirely made up, and one of the reasons that we think it might actually happen is that if you go and look at Europa, which is another icy satellite, you can see places where geological features have been displaced laterally, which suggests that this kind of backwards and forwards motion, this strike-slip motion, does actually happen. Okay, so we're going to assume that there's backwards and forwards motion, strike-slip motion, on these tiger stripes. And near the surface, you're going to get heating of that fracture plane. At depth, the ice is actually going to deform ductilely, and so the heating will be distributed over a volume, but that's essentially a detail. The important point is that the backwards and forwards motion is going to depend on how rigid Enceladus is. If Enceladus is completely rigid, it's not going to deform because of tides at all, and so you'll get no motion. If Enceladus is weak, then it'll deform a lot, and so you'll get a lot of backwards and forwards motion. And so the rigidity of Enceladus is important, and the way we parameterize that rigidity is by something called the Love number. The Love number just tells you whether it's deformable or not. A big Love number means it's deformable. And so if this mechanism is right, then it can explain the observation that the tiger stripes are hot. It can also explain the vapor production, because if you take a block of ice in vacuum and you heat it up, it's going to sublime. And so a heat source can lead to vapor generation. I'll show in a minute that to make everything work, most of that vapor doesn't actually make it out to the surface. Presumably it condenses in the near surface where everything's very cold. But so in theory, this backwards and forwards motion can explain both the heat flow and the vapor flux. All right, at some point you actually have to start putting numbers on things. So this is a kind of very, very stripped down model. Basically what we're interested in is the transport of heat and the transport of vapor. And in each case, I'm just going to describe it by a diffusion equation. The rate of change of temperature depends on heat diffusing around and also the rate of heat production because of the strike-slip motion. Similarly, you can treat the vapor as if it was diffusing through a porous medium. There's going to be some kind of effective diffusivity, and there's also the vapor is being produced by the sheer heating. Now, obviously, you can't use the same energy to both change the temperature and to produce vapor, latent heat. And so the sheer heating, I'm partitioning it between changing the temperature and producing vapor. And so this is just, this alpha is an adjustable parameter. It says how much of the energy is going into changing the temperature, how much energy is going into vapor production. So you take these two coupled models, you solve them to steady state, and you can get an answer. And this is the kind of answer you get. We're taking a slice perpendicular to the fault zone. So the fault motion is in and out of the page. And these are contours of temperature. And so you can see things get warmer as you get towards the shear zone, because that's where the heat source is. Here I'm assuming an alpha of 0.1, which means that most of my energy is actually going into vapor production rather than to actually changing the temperature. And for numbers that are representative of Enceladus, most of your heat is being produced, is being transported by the vapor. The vapor's carrying heat with it as it rises up. But there's a small amount getting conducted out of the top. So the vapor's being produced in the shear zone, and then although I don't model this bit, it's presumably recondensing in the near surface, which is basically a cold trap. It's very cold. So this is a summary of the results. What I'm doing is I'm plotting the amount of heat coming out as a function of this adjustable parameter. If alpha is 1, then all my energy is going into changing the temperature. And if alpha is 0, then I'm not changing the temperature at all, but I'm producing a lot of vapor. And you can see that for reasonable alphas in the middle, I can get the amount of heat that I actually see coming off. The key issue really is how fast are these faults moving? Because if the faults are moving fast, you generate a lot of heat. If they're moving slowly, you generate less heat. And so as you reduce the backwards and forwards motion, the total amount of heat that you get out decreases. And if you reduce the motion too much, you never produce enough heat irrespective of what alpha is. And so what this diagram is telling you is there's some kind of minimum backwards and forwards speed in order to produce the amount of heat that you actually see coming out. Okay, so we're moving heat around both by conduction and by advection. Because we don't see very much vapor coming out, most of it must be recondensing in the near surface. The stuff that you actually see coming out is a rather small fraction of the total. But the key issue is that you can work out a minimum velocity to get the amount of heat that you actually see. And this number doesn't mean anything. But basically, you need to have backwards and forwards motion of about 10 centimeters each tidal cycle. So each day, the faults are moving backwards and forwards at least like this, 10 centimeters each tidal cycle. And if you want to, you can convert that into a Love number. Remember, the Love number just tells you how deformable you are. And this velocity translates into a Love number of about 0.01. I'll tell you what that means in a second, but let me just summarize. So we know how much heat is coming off. One way of producing that heat is this backwards and forwards motion. And in order for that to work, you need a backwards and forwards motion of about 10 centimeters per tidal cycle. The vapor flux that we actually see coming off is a rather small fraction of the total that you're producing. Most of it must recondense in the near surface. The theoretical vapor velocity you get just depends on the temperature of the ice that's subliming. That works out about right. And the fact that the tiger stripes are hotter than the surroundings is just a natural consequence of this model. Okay. Let's go back to that Love number. What does that mean? Well, remember the Love number just tells you how deformable the body is. And so you can come up with a model Enceladus. Let's say it's got an ice shell and a silicate interior. And, you know, maybe it has an ocean down there and maybe it doesn't. From this theoretical model, you can predict how the Love number should vary as a function of the ice viscosity. If the ice has a very low viscosity, it's deformable, you get a big Love number. As you increase the viscosity of the ice, it becomes less and less deformable, your Love number gets smaller. We kind of know what the viscosity of ice near its melting temperature should be. That's this shaded region. And you can see that for realistic ice values, if you don't have an ocean, your Love number is very small. Enceladus just doesn't want to deform. If you put an ocean in there, now the ice shell is floating on the ocean. It's decoupled from the silicates. It can deform much more. And so if you introduce an ocean, the Love number jumps by an order of magnitude. Enceladus, the shell, is much more deformable. And if you make your ocean thicker and thicker and thicker, you become more and more and more deformable. And so the short answer is that if you want to get a Love number of greater than 0.01, you really need to have an ocean there, unless you make your ice impossibly weak. So the result of this study suggests very strongly that the reason that you get the deformation that you need is because there's an ocean somewhere beneath the surface. All right, well, that's all very well. It would always be nice to make some predictions. So one thing you can do is to look at how the temperature along the tiger stripes varies. This image was taken in 2008, a year after the original paper was published. And the original paper did make some predictions. The places I want to focus on are here. there's a cold spot here, and then here and here, there's a hot spot. A, B, C, and D are Alexandria, Baghdad, Damascus, and Cairo, and I don't know why they're not in alphabetical order. So this was the prediction from the original paper. The amount of heating that you get is going to vary both with position, where the tiger stripe is, and also what its orientation is. And so you can see that there are variations, but they're very subtle. So the prediction actually didn't do a very good job of matching the observations. But you can see, you know, Cairo here is slightly colder, Baghdad, Damascus there is slightly warmer. But in general, I'd say that's not a very good match. I think part of the reason is that when we did the original paper, we forgot to account for the fact that to accommodate the same strain rate, if your faults are close together, they don't need to move very much. If they're further apart, to accommodate the same strain, they have to move more. And so you need to take the separation into account. And if you do that, then you get this. And that starts to look a bit more convincing. Cairo is now definitely cold, and Baghdad and Damascus are definitely hotter. So if you want to try and do a quantitative comparison, you can sort of slice the tiger stripes up into boxes, and you can plot the temperature or the heat flux of each box. And so here's the data. This is looking at across Damascus. Damascus has one hot spot, which is right there, and then it decays away to either side. This is the original model prediction, which does a fine job of explaining the edges and does a very bad job of explaining all the exciting stuff. The modified model does a slightly better job. I still wouldn't say it was desperately convincing. So this is still work in progress, but you can certainly see whether your model looks plausible by comparing the model predictions with the observations. I wouldn't put it any higher than that. All right, so one potential energy source is this idea of backwards and forwards strike slip motion, which generates frictional heating. In order for that to work, you need to have some kind of minimum velocity which allows you to work out a minimum Love number. And the only way it seems reasonable to get that kind of minimum Love number is by having a subsurface ocean. The vapor flux you can get by this same mechanism, but one important point is that the stuff you're seeing coming out isn't necessarily coming directly from the ocean. It's probably just coming from the ice shell, and so we're not getting free samples of the ocean, even though that would be nice. And the predicted variations in the tiger stripe heat flux, they look something like the observations. I wouldn't put it any higher than that. So what? Well, this is a different picture from the way people normally think about tidal heating. It's concentrated on individual features. It's not distributed. And it may be important elsewhere. There are things that look a bit like the tiger stripes on Europa and Triton. The astrobiologists like this because it seems to require an ocean. And it may be important because, you know, you're taking stuff from the shell. And even if it's not coming from the ocean, you're still sampling. You can sample shell material directly without having to land something on the surface. This is a rather fanciful image of a potential future NASA mission. Oceans are important. I mean, they provide a potentially habitable environment. As you've seen, it allows the ice shell to deform more, but it also tells us something about the history of Enceladus. And so it turns out that it's not obvious that an ocean should be there. And the reason for that is as follows. An ocean lifetime is actually a pretty simple thing to calculate, because all you need to know is how much heat is being taken out of the top of the ocean and how much heat is going into the bottom of the ocean, right? And if there's more heat taken out than going in, then the ocean's going to freeze. So things get a bit more complicated because there are heat sources both in the silicates, there's radioactive decay, there may be tidal heating, and there's certainly tidal heating in the ice shell. If you're willing to assume that Enceladus is spherically symmetric, you can calculate how much heating there should be. This just shows you the distribution of heating in the ice shell and the silicate interior. The pattern, you can see there's more at the poles and less at the equator, but the important point is that there's 10 to the minus 4 times less heating in the silicates than there is in the shell. And so basically, the silicates don't get tidally heated at all. The only source of heating in the silicates is radioactive decay. What you can then do is you can take your heat production model and you can stick it into a convection model. This is the output from a 3D spherical convection model. This is the heat production. The reason that there's no heat being produced in the top half is that the top half of the convecting shell is very cold, it's rigid, it's not going to produce any heat. The individual downwellings here are just convective downwellings. This is a slice through the shell somewhere near the bottom, and you can see there's this short wavelength pattern, which is your individual downwellings, but then there's a long wavelength temperature variation, which is caused by the spatial variation in the tidal heating. You can run these models to steady state, and you can work out how much heat is being sucked out of the top of the ocean by convection. And so what I'm plotting here is the heat as a function of the shell thickness. The straight line is how much heat would be taken out if it was just a purely conductive shell, if there was no motion. And the individual points are how much heat you take out if it was convecting. The details don't really matter. The important point is that this is the amount of heat coming out, and right down here at the bottom is how much heat is going into the bottom. So you're taking out much, much more heat than you're putting in, and so the ocean's going to freeze. And if you do the calculations, the ocean is only going to last a few tens of millions of years. So it's a very short-lived feature compared to the age of the solar system. So there's negligible tidal heating in the silicates. Both conduction and convection are good at taking heat out of the ocean, and so the ocean's going to freeze, and it's going to freeze fast. This is a bit uncomfortable. We don't like short-lived oceans because you don't know how to form an ocean in the first place. And so maybe you can stick antifreeze into the ocean to stop it freezing. Ammonia is a good antifreeze, but it only helps you by a factor of two or so. It probably doesn't do enough to matter. Maybe the ocean itself has a heat source. You can imagine as the ocean gets thinner and thinner and thinner, the tides slosh backwards and forwards, and just like on the Earth, that's actually, you'll get dissipation, and that's a source of heat. Maybe that's what's going on. If the eccentricity were higher, then you get more heating in the shell, and so it acts like a better insulator. And so if Enceladus had a higher eccentricity in the past, perhaps that's what's going on, and maybe there are other mechanisms we haven't thought of. So why is Enceladus active? I think it's this backwards and forwards strike-slip motion. Does it have an ocean? Almost certainly. Not only does this mechanism seem to be required for shear heating to work, but there are other lines of evidence, like the composition of the plume material, that suggests there really is an ocean down there. But the ocean, at least from our model, seems to be a rather short-lived feature. Maybe it could have been maintained if the eccentricity were higher in the past, and so that tells you you have to start thinking about how Enceladus' orbit has evolved. The fact that it's active and the fact that it has an ocean makes astrobiologists happy because these are both sort of prerequisites for habitability. Because we can tell something about the present-day characteristics, that also makes us start to think about how Enceladus has evolved. You know, how long has the ocean been there? And I, at any rate, am left with a slightly uncomfortable feeling that maybe we're seeing Enceladus as a special time. And of course, nobody likes that because you have a sort of uniformitarian view, at least geologists do. But there are several lines of evidence that maybe we just got lucky to be looking at Enceladus now. There are several reasons for that. We've already seen that the ocean may be refreezing quite fast. Measurements of the plume composition, 40 argon comes from decay of the silicates, and it turns out that the rate at which Enceladus is getting rid of its argon now, it would have exhausted all of it in about the same time as the ocean freezes, and so that seems implausible. And then Enceladus is actually putting out more heat than it can get from its orbit in equilibrium. And so that means that we're certainly not seeing it in a steady state situation. And then finally, if you look at the surface, I mean, the surface has old bits and it has young bits. And so that suggests that there's been activity at some time, but not at other times. So maybe we're seeing Enceladus at a special time, and maybe it's not active all the time. It gives off little puffs of argon, and then it shuts down. It gives off little puffs of heat, and then it shuts down. And so you can actually see whether you can do that in models. And there are a couple of ways of doing it. This orbital thermal feedback, you can actually get periodic behavior. The eccentricity goes up and down, the heating goes up and down. Maybe that's what's happening at Enceladus. It gets hot and cold and hot and cold. But there are also kinds of convection that are episodic. And you need to tune the parameters a bit. But basically, if you have a lid that's sort of intermediate in strength, then the convection underneath, it will act as it'll have a drag force on the lid. And if you tune the parameters right, every so often the drag force will overcome the strength of the lid, and the lid will get sucked down. If you make your lid too strong, it just sticks there all the time, and you have Venus. If you make your lid too weak, it's continually getting dragged down, and you have the Earth. But if you have a sort of intermediate strength lid, it gets dragged down every so often, but the rest of the time, it's stable. And so that's what these snapshots of convection are showing, that you have a stagnant lid and downwellings, but every so often, one of these downwellings gets big enough that it actually drags the lid down into the interior, and then everything restabilizes again. So you can get episodes when the stuff overturns, at least locally, and you get a pulse of heat given off with hot material coming to the surface, and then everything settles back down. So you can get sort of episodic overturn. And this is just a plot of how much heat comes out as a function of time. And every time you get one of these episodic events, you get a spike in the heat, and then it goes back down, and then you wait a few hundred million years, and you get another spike. And you can see that for a very brief time, you can get out much more heat even than we see at the South Pole, even though the background heat production is sort of similar to Enceladus' global average. And so this may be one way of explaining what we're seeing, that we just happen to have caught Enceladus in the maybe 10% of its time when it's doing one of these overturn events. Okay, let me start to wrap up. One caveat you should bear in mind is that pretty much everything I did today was spherically symmetric. Enceladus does not look spherically symmetric to me, but if you're not spherically symmetric, everything gets much, much harder, and so that's just something I've not addressed. It'd be nice to take the more recent Cassini observations, incorporate them into models, but I think really there are several overarching questions. If you want to have a long-lived ocean, how do you do it? Because if you can't, then you have to start with a frozen Enceladus and somehow generate an ocean recently, and I don't see how you do that. And perhaps we should also be thinking about the evolution of the system. Remember that Enceladus and Dione are talking to each other, and Mimas and Tethys are also talking to each other, and so it's really a coupled system. One shouldn't just be focused on Enceladus. And of course, having developed the techniques here, we should think about other places we might be able to use them. And a particularly interesting place is Europa. Europa is a moon of Jupiter. And one thing that we know is that there may well be shear heating on Europa. There are things that look a bit like the tiger stripes. And so maybe Europa has produced vapor plumes too. The problem is that Europa's big, and its gravity is much bigger. And so even if you had Enceladus-like plumes, this is kind of what they would look like on Europa. They'd be much, much harder to detect than what they would be on Enceladus. And so they may be there in the images, but we just haven't seen them, or maybe there wasn't enough coverage. But in any case, this is the kind of thing that you'd like to go and look for in a future space mission. And there is currently a future space mission on the books. It's called Jupiter Europa Orbiter. And if things go well, then sometime in the mid-2020s, we actually may get an answer to this question. So let me summarize. I think it's active because of this backwards and forwards, tidally driven motion along the tiger stripes. And I think that to make this work, you really do need an ocean. But what I don't understand right now is how that ocean has evolved, because it seems to me that it's got to be a short-lived phenomenon, maybe unless there's something that we don't yet understand about the orbital evolution, or maybe there's episodic behavior. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.